This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 134 was recorded on September 27th, 2018. I'm Eric Townsend. IceCap Asset Management Chief Investment Officer Keith Dicker joins me as this week's feature interview guest. Keith thinks we're headed for an epic bond market crisis and has some surprising predictions for other asset classes. Be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview when Patrick and I will discuss recent articles by Marco Kolonovic and Chris Cole. We'll also have a quick update for you on our live event plans.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's talk about the S&P 500 because the stock market obviously rallied into last week. And then as that dealer gamma roll-off that we talked about came in, and then we go into the Wednesday Fed, we obviously had almost a 50-point pullback in the S&P. Yet today, it seems like it's breaking out again. All the characteristics of a typical market correction and the buy-on-dip traders coming in. Is this all we're seeing again? What's your bias here on the S&P?
Yeah, I do agree with that from a shorter time frame, from a larger time frame. You know, this feels to me like the summer of 2007, Patrick, not 8, 7. And I definitely think that we've begun a topping pattern. It's so tempting to say, wait a minute. The smartest guys in the room are all saying it's the end is nigh. It's it. The smartest guys were all saying that in the spring and summer of 2007, too. It was very clear when subprime started falling apart that something really big was afoot. But the thing is, it took a while for it to really play out in markets. So I do think that we are in a major, important topping process. But it's entirely possible that we could have, you know, 200 or 300 more points to the upside. We could be 3250 on the S&P before the final top is in and have this still be part of a topping process. Could be the top is already in, but frankly, I doubt it. I think we've got higher to go from here.
All right, well, let's move on to the dollar index because overnight we got a pretty strong reversal pattern. I mean, we were under 94 on the dollar index for a little while and a big surge, particularly coming on a very weak euro here. Do you think that that's it for the dollar index?
Well, Patrick, as you say, we're back up over 94.5. The December contract, I'm looking at 94.505 on my screen on Thursday afternoon. And we have to remember that there was backwardation between the September and December contracts. What that means is this 94.5 is really the old 95 level. So it's as if on the old number scale, we had broken back above 95 again, which was that key resistance level. Maybe that could be the beginning of something really big to the upside. Now, as bullish as my longer-term outlook has been, I've actually been surprised that we've seen this much strength. I would have thought that it would have stopped short of here, and I was kind of thinking, you know, even Charlie McElligott had a 92 target on one of his daily updates this week, and that was before the Fed hike, so it was before the most recent news that we now have available. But, you know, there was a head and shoulders pattern that was very clear. There are lots of good reason to think that we might be headed lower on the dollar before going higher. Now we seem to be going higher sooner. I don't know how long it lasts, Patrick. My bias is still bullish in the longer term, but as I've said before, I thought there was plenty of room to see a sell-off here even for the next several weeks before it eventually moved higher. Now we seem to be seeing a move higher starting already. I wonder if that might be short-lived. We'll take a look at it next week.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more because really the whole narrative of a big October push higher, particularly in the cyclicals, in my mind was going to be on the idea that the dollar remains in consolidation. If the dollar's ripping higher here, that kind of redraws a lot of the storylines on all the inner market relationships. But we'll keep an eye on that for sure. Nonetheless, let's move on to the crude oil market. Let's start off with the inventory. How did things come in?
Well, Patrick, we saw a surprise build of 1.9 million barrels. Cushing, Oklahoma, building 461,000 barrels. Gasoline, building 1.6 million barrels. Distillates, drawing down 2.2 million barrels. Production, meanwhile, ticked up. And remember that the production numbers are almost meaningless because they're rounding them to the nearest 100,000 barrels. But the point is, where we had sort of seen a downtick and people thought, oh my gosh, maybe that increase in production has finally come to an end. Well, now it's gone back up. We're at a new high of 11.1 million barrels. So the increase in U.S. production, that trend is still intact. I think right now where we are in terms of price, Patrick, is we're wedged between the five-day moving average, which as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon is at 71.74. That's sloping upward very quickly as the price has changed. And there's a key R2 resistance level at 72.68. I had been tempted when we tested that R2 resistance at 72.68 in the last couple of days. I was tempted to short it, but you know, with all of the hurricane season, and frankly, Patrick, I think the weather is even more stormy on Twitter, where Mr. Trump, the tweeter in chief, has been kind of doing battle with OPEC over oil prices. I think that there's always room for a spike higher in price. So I chickened out of the short, but I really think in a lot of ways that 72.68 level ought to contain this rally unless something else changes, like the weather. And that could be political weather or hurricane season weather. We'll see what happens. But for now, I'm on the sidelines.
It is interesting, though, that Brent has cleared 80. And even in spite of talk from Saudi Arabia, we haven't seen much of a throwback on that at all. So like a full breakout to new highs there really feels like it could drag WTI up higher.
Yeah, you know, and that goes back to what we discussed with Art Berman is in many ways, the WTI chart looks done here to me. The Brent chart actually still looks bullish. Well, they can't both, you know, have opposite directions. The spread can't widen forever. So which one's going to be proven right? I guess we'll see. My comments about where the resistance looks like it should occur really were based on looking at the WTI chart. And I agree with you. The Brent chart tells a more bullish story. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens.
All right, Eric, let's talk gold because, you know, it looked like gold was finally consolidating, maybe even could potentially base. But as soon as the Fed meeting finished and the dollar popped, gold right back below 1200 again. What's going on here? What's your thinking here?
Well, the move down in gold, and we're looking at 1188 as we're speaking Thursday afternoon, came as no surprise whatsoever because it's all about the dollar. We saw the pop up in the dollar. And if the dollar continues to move up, gold's going to continue to move down. The thing is, I'm really wondering if this pop in the dollar has any staying power. Maybe there's something I'm not aware of yet. But as I saw it, there was a lot of reasons for even a dollar bull like myself to be thinking, we might be in a consolidation to distribution phase here where maybe we're going to move a bit lower on the dollar before it finally turns around and moves higher. So if we still see that move lower on the dollar, there's room for gold to pop here, and that would mean right here, right now, this is your opportunity. We have only seen gold lower for one day, I think, you know, in the last year and a half than it is right now on Thursday afternoon. And, of course, that day was just back in August when we saw that move all the way down to 1165 or so. So it could be that this is your opportunity. The thing is, I'm surprised by this strength in the dollar. If it continues, you know, it's going to be a sad story for gold. So I would stay on the sidelines. I do think in many ways that gold is really going to have a huge run to the upside when it's time. And we're going to get into this in today's interview with Keith. And it'll be a fascinating conversation because you can make the argument that gold's headed to 800 and you can make the argument that gold's headed to 8,000. I think it is headed to 8,000. It just might be headed to 800 first. So I really don't have a strong opinion here, but I think there's plenty of room if this dollar pop is short-lived for this to be at least a short-term buying opportunity for people with a shorter time horizon.
Well, Eric, I want to come back to this in the post game because Marco Kolonovic had a really interesting comment on this in a recent piece that he did. And I think his insights on gold are pretty interesting. So we'll get back to that in the post game. Well, let's move on to 10-year treasury yields because we were literally at the edge of the cliff. We were at 3.10 on the yield and we were just waiting to find out what happened with the Fed. And after the Fed announcement, we come off of there. We're, I think, around the 3.05 level now on the yield. Do you think that that becomes now an overhead resistance? I mean, one day doesn't make a new trend. We have a little more information to find out. But what's your thinking here?
Well, as you know, Patrick, this is the way resistance levels work. They tease you. They play with your emotions. It's like, oh, it's going to break. It's going to break. It's going to break. It was coming up into the Fed meeting that everybody was teetering on the edge, waiting for that breakout to occur on the news. And I think it was a buy the rumor, sell the news event. People were anticipating maybe the Fed hike was going to be the thing that did it. I don't think there's a really good reason to anticipate that outcome because this Fed hike was widely anticipated. There were no big surprises here. So the fact that we hit the resistance level is no surprise. And hey, resistance is working as resistance. We didn't move and close over 3.10. And really, I think you'd have to say 3.14 would be the number to close over in order to get an upward signal, which of course would be a sell signal on the bonds because they move inversely with the direction of the yield. In any case, it ain't over till it's over. Right now, what we've seen is a failed test of resistance. We're back down to where we were trading a week ago. I think it's a big question to see what happens not only with the 10-year, but also, as Julian Brigden mentioned on our show several months ago, I'm very curious to see, you know, month end is coming up just tomorrow. What if we saw a move up in yield that took the 30-year back above 3.25, which is Julian Brigden's call for on a closing basis as a game changer that would change a 30-year trend in the bond market? So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens next. It's definitely time to pay close attention to what bond yields are doing. But Patrick, I know some of our listeners want to pay attention to what you are doing, and that is speaking at the Silver and Gold Summit in San Francisco, October 28th and 29th. What's going on? What are you talking about? And is there a deal for Macro Voices subscribers?
Absolutely. I'm going to be, of course, talking about gold, silver, and particularly the use of options on them. So it's going to be pretty exciting. But what all of our Macro Voice listeners should be most excited about is the past guests that we've had on this show that are also going to be speaking there. Not only is Marin Katusa going to be speaking there, Rick Rule is going to be speaking there, Grant Williams from Things That Make You Go, and Real Vision is going to be speaking there, as well as Brent Johnson. So there's a great lineup coming. And what's amazing is that we were able to negotiate with the Cambridge House to get a 30% discount for our Macro Voice listeners using the promo code MACRO. If you get in before October 1st, it's the early bird phase one. And then between now and October 12th, it's early bird phase two. You get an additional 30% off of the already discounted prices. So if you want to come out and see that great lineup and meet me and everything, come on out. Otherwise, though, Eric, what's in store for our Vancouver show? What's going on there?
Well, let's keep it super tight, but we got a lot of feedback. We were thinking, okay, Vancouver, we'll just go to the resource conference in Vancouver and maybe hang out and have a beer with our listeners afterwards. People are really pushing us to do an event like we did in Toronto. The Vancouver crowd thinks that they deserve one just as good. So we're thinking about doing Vancouver January 19th. That would be the day before the January 20th and 21st Vancouver Natural Resource Investment Conference. Don't buy your ticket yet for the Vancouver Resource Investment Conference because we'll be bundling admission to that with whatever we do. George is still negotiating with the hotels. We'll see where that goes. Meanwhile, we're still going to do a U.S. event someday, but I think we'll probably push it out to the spring. We've had a lot of feedback that people prefer a two-day format, and we're thinking Dallas instead of Vegas right now, also considering Atlanta and Miami. But if you haven't yet, take our survey to tell us your desires there. We'll let you know when we have something final. Analyzed.
All right. Well, thanks for the update, Eric. So now this week's featured interview guest is IceCap Asset Management's Keith Dicker. Eric's interview with Keith is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is IceCap Chief Investment Officer Keith Keith Dicker. Keith, thanks so much for joining us on the program. You've prepared a fantastic slide deck for us. Listeners, you'll find the download link to the slide deck in your Research Roundup email. If you're not registered yet, just go to our homepage at macrovoices.com. Look for the information next to Keith's picture for how to get the download. Keith, you know, the narrative that a lot of people would like us to believe is, hey, Ben Bernanke has pretty much saved the economy. Quantitative easing rescued the financial markets, and hey, everything's all better now. What could go wrong? I tend to be in the camp that at some point the piper has to be paid. There's no free lunch. But a lot of people have challenged, you know, what form will that come in? Where does the piper still need to be paid? And I think you've addressed a lot of those questions in your chart book. So why don't we go ahead and get started here on page one. Tell us what's going on with what's coming on this first chart.
Yeah, sure thing. Thanks. Thank you, Eric, for having me on today. So we'll have a good chat here. With IceCap Asset Management, our global macro view, it's attracted a lot of attention from around the world. And what we find most interesting is that, you know, this conversation we'll have today, it's happening in the U.S., happening across Europe, Canada, Asia, you name it. So it's not a country-specific concern that investors have today. This is really a global situation that we're in. So that's what we'll touch upon. You know, so you mentioned Bernanke saved the day and all that stuff. Our view is, a little bit different. When we look at the world today, you know, because we are a global macro shop, it's really important to understand that we do not live in a linear world. And when you put on top of that, once we understand how central banks and the Western world specifically, how they operate the economy and the global financial system, then you'll better be able to see exactly what's coming down the pipe here. And, you know, to give you the conclusion first, we have a very high conviction, there's a very high probability that we have another crisis that it's coming in view right now. It's really started to ramp up this year. And we expect to see a significant crisis across the fixed income sphere. So most specifically, most likely sovereign debt, but it will spread across the entire fixed income industry. And so we'll talk about that, why that's going to come and what's happening. So when we're looking at a first slide deck that we have here, what we like to point out to people is that, you know, everyone in the business today in investing, we all remember the tech bubble almost 20 years ago now. You know, that created about $5 trillion in losses. And then next up from that, the housing bubble is about $15 trillion, you know, three times bigger. What we have happening today in the bond world, no one has seen that happen before. So every crisis that we've seen in the world today, in our lifetime, it's always originated and then reflected in the stock market. So no one is really prepared for what's happening in the bond world. And the best way to look at it, when we look at central banks, you know, whether it's Bernanke or, you know, Yellen after her, and even Greenspan back towards that, the entire Western world, Eric, they've based their economy on Keynesian economics. And basically what that means for everyone is that when there's a crisis, the government will increase spending, so they'll run a bigger deficit because that's going to stimulate the economy. And then central banks, on top of that, you know, they'll cut interest rates to make credit easier to flow and easier for people to borrow and so forth. And what's really happened over time, so just going back to our first slide we have here, every time that there's been a crisis in our lifetime, the actions of the central banks and governments, specifically in the Western world, that by saving one crisis, they really sowed the seeds for the next crisis. So all the losses that we had back in 08 and 09, you know, they were never realized. They were simply, you know, taken away from the private sector and pushed over on the balance sheets of the government sector. So they like to call it, they socialized the bad debt losses. But we have another bubble that has been created, and most of the world, they're just not ready for it, because they're not used to living in a world where fixed income can be risky and equities can actually be safe.
Moving on to the second slide, it looks like you're kind of transposing the usual perspective. Normally, people think of government bonds as the safest thing that there is. The risk is in the stock market. You seem to be showing a different view here.
Yeah. Well, what we like to tell people is that, you know, we've all been bred to believe that bonds are always safe, stocks are risky, you know, therefore, in the CFA world, we live on this modern portfolio theory line where you get a combination of stocks and bonds. That's why you have all your balanced funds out there in the world. And it's important for investors today, though, to realize this investment experience we've had in the bond market in our lifetime, it's really been predicated upon long-term interest rates going from high to low. Whenever rates go down, bond markets go up. And it's the easiest market to make money in. But we've never lived in the period where long rates start to go higher. And what we'll talk about now in a second is that when, unlike overnight rates with either the Fed or any other central banks in the Western world, usually you can tell what they're going to do with overnight rates. Long-term interest rates, they surge. They go from 1 to 3 to 6 very quickly. And that hasn't happened in our lifetime. So because of that, people are not ready for what happens in the bond world. The other thing to consider is that most of the investors that we've experienced in our career, these are truly global investors. So these are people that have lived their lives in multiple countries, they have multiple currencies in their pocket, they have no home country bias. It's incredibly important for the average investor to know that with these investors, as soon as they get a sniff of trouble in the world, they run away from it. And that's hugely important to know because, you know, the way the math works out, of course, you get a 50% loss in anything. You need a 100% return to get back to where you started. So avoiding losses in your portfolio, they're critical. And once we begin to see danger and a crisis re-escalating in any market, that this large pool of capital in the world, they're going to run away from it. And once that begins to happen, then people will realize very quickly, oh, wow, that market is trouble. And it's important, though, to understand that when capital leaves one market, it goes to another market for safety. And those that follow us, they know that we believe there's going to be a lot of capital seeking safety in U.S. dollars, as well as certain parts of equity markets as well. So we're expecting a very different market outcome from what happens in the upcoming crisis in the bond market and what we've traditionally been led to believe what would happen.
Let me ask you a couple of follow-ups on that, because one view that you'll hear from a lot of people that we've talked to on this program is, look, the real risk is in the bond market, same thing as you're saying, and that means we're going to get to a situation which is unusual in which both stocks and bonds are selling off together, and that really means a lot of trouble for risk parity strategies and so forth. But there's another view, and I'm curious what you think about it, which is, wait a minute, it could actually go the other direction. To the point where there is so much danger in bond markets, particularly with the negative yielding sovereign debt that exists around the world. I mean, it's just so ridiculously overvalued that sell-off, because bond markets are so much bigger than stock markets, that you could actually see the safety trade out of government bonds into stocks, and you could surprise everyone with the stock market moving up in a crisis because it is the safety trade, which is hard to get your head around, but it seems plausible. What do you think about that view?
Yeah, we're 90% in the latter camp, Eric. However, before we get to that, though, the initial reaction, so when this crisis re-escalates, it'll be a pretty big pop in the world. We fully expect equities will come down a little bit in the beginning. Whether that number is significant or not, as a manager, we would have different models in place that would help us guide us through that moment. But once this crisis really does begin to escalate in the fixed income world, it's very likely money will flow into equities as a safe haven. I often say to investors, who would you rather trust with your money? The board of IBM or the Italian government? You usually get a chuckle out of it sometimes, but that's really what you're coming down to. But what we expect will happen in the fixed income world, people will, what we call sliding down the curve, so duration will get hit specifically. Any type of a spread product, whether it's credit or high yield or emerging market debt, that's going to get hit as well. So money will seek safety within the fixed income world, which will be short duration and specifically treasuries as well as bonds for that matter. There's a high probability that equities can do extremely well, and that's going to cause a lot of the value investing guys out there to sort of spin around because, as we say in our today, I tell people valuations, they don't matter in the world right now. They will at some point in time, But right now, if you're a value investor, you're saying, wow, like none of these numbers make sense, you know, yet, you know, U.S. equities continue to go up very strongly. So we often tell people, you know, it's not that markets should do what you expect them to. You have to sit back and say, markets are doing this and why. And that really supports this theme that we're talking about.
Moving on to slide 3, you're showing obviously this huge secular bull market in bonds, lowering yields ever since 1982. You've got an up arrow at the end here. I'm very curious to know your view, because we've had a lot of different people on this program express differing views from, oh boy, it looks like it might be over, to it's definitely over, to we're sure it's over, we're betting the farm on it's over. So do you think that the bottom is in on Treasury yields and it's all uphill from here? Or are we in kind of a bottoming process where we're not sure if there's another wave down that might take us to a new lower low in yield?
Yeah, the first part of the comment with this slide, this slide is so simple, it's perfect. What we're showing everyone here is just the history of the U.S. 10-year. So it's really, it's a proxy for long-term interest rates. And what we see is in the early part of the 60s, you know, long rates went from, you know, 2.5% right up to almost 20% in 1982, depending on which rate mark you're looking at. And then from 82 down to basically just last year, you know, went down to zero. And this is the key thing that most investors are really missing in the marketplace. We've all lived in a market, in a career, in a market environment where bond funds have always done well. So when you have long-term rates going from 20% to zero, any bond manager in the world can make money. It's the biggest bull market we've ever experienced in fixed income. And what's interesting, if you think about this more from a practical perspective, we always try to make things very simple for clients to understand. So I started working in the business back in the early 90s. So I was trained by a person who worked in the 80s. I then trained the person when I was in the late 90s, early 00s. I trained the earlier person 10 years behind me and so forth. Everyone in the business today, most people have either only lived and worked or been trained by someone only lived and worked in a period where long-term rates have only gone down. And the reason we say this, because it's hugely important to know that the majority of the industry has never experienced a market with long-term rates going higher. Then on top of that, they've never experienced a crisis in the bond market before. So, you know, we like to tell people that the bond market, you know, think of it, as you mentioned, the bond market, it has dwarfed the size of equity markets. But it's a crowded gymnasium. There's no liquidity to get out. You can move inside the market if you want, but it's similar to having a gymnasium that's packed and there's one door open at the end. You just cannot get out of it. So to go back to your question, Eric, the long end of the curve, it's clearly already starting to move up. You know, whether you're looking at the U.S. with the 10-year, you know, we've gone from 1 to 3 now in about a year and a half. Same thing is happening in Canada. It's happening in other markets as well. But the big point to understand is when we look at the yield curve today, let's just turn to the next page, Eric, just sort of express this point a bit better. A normal functioning bond market has a yield curve where short-term rates are lower than long-term rates. Since the crisis in 08 and 09, because we've had so much, I call it interference from central banks, but we've had over $14 trillion in various forms of money printing, quantitative easing. Then you put on top of that, we had about 700 rate cuts around the world. Then we've had a negative interest rate policy, and then, you know, of course, still have negative rates, you know, across most of Europe and Japan. That has artificially suppressed the yield curve. So in everyday language, it means that the price of bonds has been artificially locked in place where the private sector has not been able to get in and really affect what the price of bonds should be. When we talk about a crisis in the bond market occurring, it's because long-term bonds, all of a sudden, they are now freed from suppression by central banks, and they're now open to the private sector to start repricing again. And when you get a repricing in the bond world, the long-term rates are going to go from 1 to 3 to 6, and then 12, and this came over. It's similar to what happened to Italy back in 2011 and 12, you know, back when they had the crisis there, when Berlusconi was kicked out overnight, and then the ECB stepped in to save the day. So that's what we see happening. We do not believe that the long end is simply going to be affected by inflation expectations or the economic cycle. The key really comes down to what's happening from central banks, specifically in Europe, and that's going to catch a lot of investors by surprise.
Let me just ask a follow-on on that, because the last time that this happened, when we saw interest rates bottom, was at the end of World War II. And, of course, that was a very different set of circumstances. But a lot of people expected a V-shaped recovery, and it didn't really happen. It ended up being a U-shaped recovery, where those very low rates stayed about the same, very low, for 10 years. And then they finally started to take off. You're expecting rates to V-shape here and to take off. Is that specifically because of central banks withdrawing their liquidity? And if so, it seems to me like there's a, at some point, as soon as this starts to take off, maybe they go back to their old ways and try to suppress them some more. So what do you see on the horizon there?
You know, really, we tell people we're having this moment in time. You know, every crisis is a little bit different, but a lot of it is the same from previous crises. But right now, we're really experiencing a collision between social, economic, political, and monetary factors around the world. So everything is hitting each other at the same time. It's created this chaos, whether it's within politics or social or economic and financial markets. And there's a lot of confusion out there, what is going to happen. Our view on why we get this crisis in the bond market, it's a combination of two things. One, the financial conditions are just perfect for it. We'll show you in a little bit that when you look at the percentage of many countries and their percentage of their tax revenues that had to go towards paying just interest on their debt outstanding, it's significant. But it becomes even more significant once rates rise. So that will have a pretty difficult effect on a lot of governments trying to maintain their budgets. But the other part of it, though, is it really comes from the social and political side of the equation. There's a lot of unhappiness around the world right now, and that is getting reflected in the political world. And when we look specifically over in Europe, the Eurozone as well as the EU, the divide between the left versus the right, it's growing by the day, and it's becoming increasingly difficult for the Eurozone, specifically the EU, to maintain what they have. And specifically when we look at what's happening in Italy these days, it's very likely that Italy is the one that will ultimately be the epicenter for this crisis re-escalates again. And it's coming at the exact moment of time where the ECB, they have to unwind their QE. Draghi's term is up now next year. The German government, they are against the ECB's policy with QE. They want to turn it off. So at the exact moment in time where political and social stress are colliding with each other, it's the exact moment of time when the financial markets aren't able to absorb that type of crisis. So that's what we see really happening.
Now, I just want to follow up on that again, because what I can see is you've got, as you say, I couldn't possibly agree more with what you just said, which is we have a mounting economic crisis. Yeah, I agree. But boy, the mounting social crisis around the world is bigger, and it is going to have a greater impact on what governments are forced to do, because they're going to be dealing with outright riot kind of situations among their constituents. It seems to me like the thing that governments cannot afford is a secular reversal of the direction in interest rates, because they're so over indebted now that they would be unable to afford to service their debt. And it seems to me that they would need to increase that debt with more deficit spending in order to deal with some of the social issues that you're talking about. So it seems to me like a setup for governments to panic at some point and say, we got to go back to doing everything we possibly can to suppress rates because we're screwed otherwise. Am I wrong to think they're going to find themselves in that pickle? And when they do, is there anything they're going to be able to do about it, or are they going to have to just suffer like the rest of us through higher rates?
Well, obviously we have a very similar view on what might happen here. But, first of all, when we say government, we specifically mean the elected office. and, you know, of course, then the ministries underneath them. You really have to separate that from the central bank within each country. To make an assumption that, you know, any government in the world today, you know, whether it's the American, Canadian, British, you name it, I find it's extremely unlikely any of these guys are going to be able to anticipate any crisis and then be proactive towards it. They just don't work that way. Even in Canada, for example, during the last federal election, I had the Liberal Party stop by one evening. You know, they were canvassing for their vote, and, you know, they don't realize I'm a money guy. That's just the world I live in. It's pretty black and white to me. I asked them, and I said, you know, what are the Liberals going to do with the deficit that you're expected to come up? And there was a whole team, and there was about six or seven canvassing in the neighborhood that night. And they all gathered around me, and they said, well, we're expecting a $2 billion deficit. And I looked at them, I said, that's impossible. Oh, that's going to be, I said, you guys are going to be at least $20 billion. For all these things that you're going to do, you're not going to hit $2 billion. It's going to be way north of that. You know, and they quickly scribble in their books, you know, that this may not be someone supporting their party. But what happened afterwards, of course, you know, the Canadian deficit in the first year was $30 billion. So remember, they're telling voters it's going to be $2 billion and the final number is $30. So to expect governments to be on top of this, I think that's just, this is wishful thinking. The best way to really demonstrate what's happening, Eric, let's just shoot straight through to slide number 12. So it's entitled Sovereign Debt Has Exploded. So this is a chart that's showing what the growth has been in total debt, and it's separated between the developed world and emerging markets. So, and what it shows here is that from 2006, just before the last crisis, up to 2016, so just a 10-year period, the debt outstanding in the developed world has grown, what, 25%. So from 128 trillion to 160 trillion. That's pretty significant. That's big. The most important point to understand, though, is that underneath this, debt in the emerging market world has grown by 250%. So 10 times stronger growth of borrowing in the emerging market world. When we look at how the emerging market world, how they borrow, the two points to know is that they are primarily borrowing in U.S. dollars, so that instantly creates a shortage of dollars in the world. So it is a short of dollars, which means that in the future they have to buy dollars back for this. And then if you look over to our next page, on page slide 13 here, this is the data point I referred to there a few minutes ago, showing the percentage of government's tax revenues that has to be allocated towards interest on debt outstanding. All of these rates today are currently based upon artificially suppressed interest rates around the world, with the central banks being heavily involved in suppressing the yield curve. So when we look at, hey, can government save the day, they'll be reactive. That's all they'll be. They cannot be proactive. So it's only after rates start surging higher and governments sit down and, you know, they do their budgets and they say, holy smokes, you know, we used to allocate 6% of our budget for paying interest on the debt. Now it's going to be 12%. So that's less money left over for this and that. And that's happening at an exact point in time when borrowing for dollars is becoming, you know, the demand is just increasing even more. So I hold very little hope that governments around the world will be able to be proactive to correct this from happening. That they won't be able to do it. And that's the same with central banks as well, Eric. Right now, the Fed has already stated when they started raising rates now just recently that, you know what, we're no longer going to be the central bank for the world. We're changing our view. We're looking after the U.S., and every time you have the Fed raising rates, while the rest of the world continues to have QE running as well as negative rates and zero rates, that just sucks more foreign capital into the U.S. market, which makes it even worse for foreign currencies and foreign debt markets. So this is setting up to be, in our view, one of the easiest macro calls to make in our lifetime. And because of that, there's a significant opportunity coming up for people to both make and lose money. So, you know, people have to decide whether to recognize this is a risk and be able to capitalize on it, because we can't stop it from happening, or, you know, just to ignore it all altogether, which is really going to hurt a lot of people's portfolios.
Keith, thanks for jumping ahead to answer my question, but I want to go back to where we left off. Let's go back to slide number 6. You're showing warning number 1 here. What's the warning?
Oh, boy. This, you know, again, we really separate the industry from investment markets. And what we like to do with these next few slides is to demonstrate to investors that, you know, in our mind, 90% of the investment world, they're not making big investment decisions. It's always thrown against the benchmark and managed cash flows, and that's it. What we're showing here on page 6, we call it warning number 1. So this, again, this is the U.S. 10-year. And this is what happened. It's showing the history of the 10-year from 1982 to the end of 2016. We like to show this because this is what's happened with long-term rates in the U.S. immediately after the 2016 American election. And so what happened after that, people were following equity markets, of course, but within about a 48-hour span, the U.S. 10-year went from 1.7% to 2.4%. So a 70 basis point rise effectively overnight. For most investors, they say, you know, Keith, round it, it's gone from 2 to 2. Like, there's no big change here. But this small 70 basis point change in long-term rates, it just created so much chaos in the bond market world. I was actually visiting with, I had meetings with one of the largest bond managers at the time about a week after this happened. And I say to them, you know, how are the last few days for you guys, with one being everything's great and things haven't been very good? And, you know, they looked at each other and they said, it was an ace. And I said, wow. So, you know, a 70 basis point unexpected increase in the 10-year to cost these guys, one of the biggest bond managers in the world, to go down for an 8 count. If you look at the slide here, you know, we have the headline stories from that day. One from Bloomberg is saying, global bonds suffer worst monthly meltdown as $1.7 trillion lost. Another one says, sleepy bond market started by November like no other. Again, this is to warn people that the industry and the bond market is not ready for a crisis or a long-term surge in rates. And then the same thing happens again on the next slide on page 7, warning number 2. So this here took place back in just about, you know, 7 to 8 months after the U.S. election in Japan. And I woke up one morning and I'm going through data points, see what's happening, and the Japanese bond market, it's going crazy. So what happened to cause it to go crazy? The 10-year in Japan, the Japanese government bond 10-year, went from 0.10% yield to 0.125, so a 2.5 pip increase. And the BOJ went nuts. They said, we will never tolerate this again, and they bought everything they could in sight, you know, to bring the bond yields down again. Again, demonstrating that the second biggest bond market in the world, they couldn't tolerate, you know, a 0.0012% change in the yield curve. We go to warning on page number 8 here, same thing in Canada in August of 2017. You see the title here from a Bloomberg story, how funds are regrouping after worst Canada bond route since 94. Same thing in the bottom corner, they talk about the Australian bond market. On page 9, Eric, it's probably the best, one of the best, easiest slides that we've shown in a while. This has come from March of this year, so not too far back. It's another Bloomberg story, and they say, not a single Japanese 10-year bond traded on Tuesday. Again, that's just crazy stuff. So an equivalent in the stock market, that would be saying, like, 0 shares of Google traded today. People are not ready for this lack of liquidity in a crisis in the bond market. And then the most recent one, of course, which should really plant the seed in everyone's head that, you know, the central banks are really suppressing rates, specifically in Europe. What we're showing here is what happened with the Italian 2-year bond. It's just sort of refresh everyone's mind. You know, the Italians, they had their election back in the spring. And, you know, leading up to, we wrote about this. We said, you know, it's very clear what's going to happen in Italy with the political scene. The two parties leading in the poll, number 1 and number 2, their main political platform, you know, they're both flipping the bird to the EU and the Eurozone in Brussels. And so, like, these guys are going to win, and this is going to create chaos in the European bond market. Sure enough, these guys win, and markets were somehow surprised by it. And, you know, of course, a few days later, this new coalition party in Italy, they appoint their new Finman, the financial minister, and this guy's entire career has been dedicated to trying to tear up the Eurozone. And the first thing that happens the next morning, Brussels and Frankfurt and the ECB, they get together and say, well, you know, the Italians are really rocking the boat down there. How about shooting one across the bow? And the ECB said, sure, no problem. So instead of buying Italian bonds that day, they sell some on the market. And this is the key point, again, where the market is not ready for this, that the two-year yield in Italy went from 0.2% to 2.4% in one day. So 0.2 to 2.4%. You know, that's equivalent of a stock going from 100 down to 2, like within hours. This should be sending shivers down your spine if you're long the bond market, or, you know, cause you to jump up here with excitement if you're short the bond market. Because we're getting these consistent warning shots that the market is not ready for a crisis in the bond market, and the bond market itself, you know, is not ready for it. So this is enormous. This is a terrific opportunity coming up, depending on how you position your portfolios.
So, Keith, to summarize all of this, it sounds to me like your views are very similar to my own. Let me state my own view and tell me, first of all, if it's similar, but most importantly, it's the what happens next and what can we do about it. My view has been that, you know, what we've done with short-sighted thinking is central banks have solved all of the symptoms of the last crisis by creating artificially low interest rates that have propped us up into this negative yielding sovereign debt situation where there's no room left. When we get to the next crisis, you can't go to the safety of bonds because bonds are not safe. So we've got, at a minimum, the bond market, which is four times bigger than the stock market, selling off in a way that could be self-reinforcing. It becomes a question of what could happen there. And it happens at a time when we're already reaching a boiling point on social crises around the world. And I think that what it creates, most likely, is a situation where governments go into a financial crisis at the same time they're coping with a social crisis. And according to old school Keynesian philosophy, they most need to spend a lot of money on deficit at a time when markets are least allowing them to do so. So I guess the first question is my summary, which is my own view that I've had for many years about where we are, consistent with yours. But more importantly, to whatever extent it is, what the heck does that mean in terms of what's coming? Because I think when we get to the next crisis, it's not a question of just turning on the printing presses and more QE. It's a really global social crisis that I'm not sure what it's going to lead to.
Yeah, I agree, Eric. You know, our views are quite similar. We tell people that we believe there's a very high probability that the world does trend towards what we expect. So that is going to happen. As for how it turns out, we think we'll probably be 80% correct financial with market-wise. So the first part of your question from a social, political side, there's going to be a lot of angry people out there. That will happen. Because, again, like the conversation that we're having today and people listening, I think that represents a very small percentage of the marketplace. Most people are oblivious to these types of conversations that are happening. So, there will be a lot of confusion out there, and it will create some unfortunate times for a lot of people. In terms of the marketplace and how this transpires, Eric, you know, the central banks have always been reacting towards a crisis that, you know, that's been created by the private sector. You know, you and I, you know, we caused the housing crisis. You know, we caused the tech bubble and so forth. Once this crisis re-escalates again in the bond world, there's no blueprint for it. So I'm not quite sure how it looks, what the reaction will be from central banks. And specifically, you know, everyone will be looking towards the Fed. I mean, even back in 2008, a lot of investors don't realize is that without the Fed opening their lines to Europe would have went under. And everyone starves for dollars. Like the U.S. dollar, it's the only market big enough in the world to put money into during times of crisis. So, you know, people listening to this today, they're hearing your view, and you know, a lot of other people have similar view with it as us. As bad as things may seem in the U.S. right now, from a singular perspective, the U.S. dollar has the real potential to go significantly higher here. And we tell people really with markets, you have to think of the world from a currency perspective. And we tell people really only three currencies matter in the world. So think of the U.S. as the foundation base. Next to that, you have Japanese yen. And then on top of that is euro. Every other currency is sort of, you know, swirling around it, just making noise. We anticipate crisis in eurozone first. Capital will flow into yen and dollars for safety. And then all of a sudden, once the crisis, you know, more or less has sorted itself out in euro land, then it'll hit the world of Japanese yen. Then, you know, finally then, you know, the dollar will have their day as well. So, you know, to get through this, thinking in a linear fashion will not work. You have to understand that it's going to be very fluid. Things happen extremely quickly. But and the main blueprint is that no one is ready for it. So, you know, you and I, we can't change it. Talking about today will help a lot of investors prepare for it. But this is happening, and, you know, it is what it is.
With the dollar strengthening as it already has, it's retraced just barely more than half of the move down over the last year or so. And that already seems to be creating a crisis in emerging markets. If we move to new highs above 104, whatever the recent peak was a little over a year ago, what does that mean for emerging markets and what's the transmission mechanism into developed markets from there?
Well, first of all, you know, the recent strength in dollar, That's just been a, you know, it has been strength theory, but it's not what we expect. We expect a surge in money going into USD. So whether we're measuring it, you know, by DXY or whatever other currency you want to look at, we're telling people that this is nothing. This hasn't even started. Yes, if the dollar once it does begin to strengthen, remember all this happens simultaneously. You don't have a strong dollar and then emerging markets experience a weakness. You know, one leads to the other. It's going to be extremely difficult in the emerging market world. So we're already seeing it now in several countries. It's happening. And what I find most unfortunate, you know, just sort of a side note, we continue to get calls from fund companies, ETF manufacturers, you know, trying to sell us emerging market debt funds. And I say to the guys, are you joking? Do you have any idea what's happening in the world? And they don't. You know, they look at it as, you know, the old story with emerging markets is that, you know, the fundamentals are better than the developed world. They're growing faster, lower debt, better workforce, and stuff like that. But again, they just don't understand that probability of this group hitting a more severe crisis. It'll dwarf what happened in 97 and 98 with the Asian crisis back then. That's happening. And, you know, and because we live on a global yield curve, banks are, they're in a global funding space. That's where they are. You know, one crisis in one market leads to the next, which to the next, to the next. You know, I often get people to ask me, you know, they say, Keith, you know, what will, you know, cause the housing market in Toronto and Vancouver to slow down? And I say to them, oh, that's easy. I said, it'll be Italy. And, you know, they look at me, have 10 heads. And I say, well, no, we asked about Toronto. And I said, yeah, you know, you go through the Italian bond market, how they're relying on the ECB, you know, to finance their deficit, and, you know, you go down that route, and then you get, you know, they look at you like with deer in headlights. But the main point here is, you know, whether it's the Canadian market or U.S. or emerging market world, everyone lives on the same yield curve, and a crisis in one part of the market, it just spreads into the other. I know we talk a lot about the bond market today. But again, we tell people it's extremely important to know that no one asset class operates in isolation. Like, there's no zero correlation among asset classes. They're all connected. And, you know, this crisis that's facing us is coming up. It's going to be fixed income, currency driven. It's going to cause a lot of capital to go scattering around the world.
Let's touch on gold briefly because, you know, according to conventional wisdom, at least, if you're expecting a huge surge up in the dollar, that should be extremely bearish for gold. On the other hand, your larger picture outlook in terms of a major bear market in bonds could potentially be extremely beneficial to gold. So is it time for gold yet? Where's the trade there?
It could be time. With ICECAP, you know, we tell people we're asset class agnostic. You know, in more simpler terms, we don't love or hate any one asset class. As an example, we had a pretty significant allocation to gold bullion back in 11 and 12. And, people in the gold world, they all remember what happened next. You know, gold broke from almost hit 2,000 and then down to 16, then 12, and it's been there ever since. People who follow gold, they all know the same fundamental story, you know, why it should be surging and the reasons why it hasn't and so forth. You know, we're a lot simpler with that. You know, we don't disagree with that storyline. However, when any asset class or market, when it breaks specific support levels, you have to respect that, you know, whether it's on the upside or downside. So, what we know, once gold broke back then, our last trade was out at 1648. And we haven't been back in since. And our story, of course, that we tell people from a market perspective, that we do expect the dollar to become extremely strong. And initially, Eric, we expect that will be negative for gold. We think gold, it has an opportunity here to come down one more thump. But after that, we can see a period where both gold and dollar, you know, it does very well. So with us, we have our current strategies in place. Then we also have, you know, other strategies on deck, and we've had gold on deck now. People have been following us. You know, they'll say, yeah, you know, ICECAP's been saying this for a while. We've had gold on deck now for a couple of years. We really want to add gold to the portfolio, but the conditions are still on there. Gold remains weak, but we think the long-term outlook is quite big, but you got to get through this dollar market first.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I really, really believe gold is going to have its day in the sun, and I think it's going to be the trade to be in. But I don't think it's time yet. I think we got more down before we go up. I want to go back, though, to something you just said about people following you. You guys have been extremely popular. Zero Hedge has really taken a liking to your research work. For people who are interested in following your work, please tell us more about what you do at ICECAP Asset Management and where people can learn more about it.
Yeah, sure thing. So ICECAP Asset Management, we provide investment portfolios for individuals as well as institutions. We are what we call absolute return. So in more technical terms, benchmark on constraints. So we really focus on avoiding markets that we expect are going to produce losses. As was mentioned earlier, the importance of doing that. And, you know, constructing portfolios the right way, you know, really from a currency perspective first and going out from that. For our global outlook, Eric, people can sign up for that. It's free. It's on our website at icecapassetmanagement.com. And we're on Twitter as well at ICECAP Global.
Well, Keith, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Keith. I actually want to opine in on what he was saying, but I want to first get your opinion. What did you take away from the interview?
Well, Patrick, what this one really got me thinking about is I agree with Keith that we're likely going to see the next major financial crisis be primarily a bond market crisis. It's the bond market that governments have most propped up with quantitative easing. That's where the most largesse exists. That's what could get unwound. And the thing it really makes you think about is, okay, nobody anywhere is prepared, if the way that institutional money has always been run, that the only thing that anybody in the business knows how to do is your safety trade when everything else is falling apart, is the U.S. 10-year treasury. That's your safe instrument no matter what. Well, what happens, Patrick, when the U.S. 10-year treasury is exactly what you're running away from, what you don't want to be invested in? Now, keep in mind that institutional investors by mandate, you know, the gold bugs would love to say, that's when they're all going to go to gold. Well, look, they can't go to gold because by mandate, they're not allowed to invest in gold. They have to invest within their mandate. So, you know, we actually had at one point Keith saying, you know, it could be that the equity market becomes the safety trade where equities are moving up as the bond market is crashing. Now, that seems utterly crazy on the surface of it, but you've got to ask yourself, if the bond market is crashing, where does the money go? Presumably, it goes into shorter duration fixed income. Well, what happens when all of the shorter duration fixed income gets bought up? It's a fascinating question, and I don't necessarily think that the answer has to be stock market surprises everybody and goes up when you would expect it to crash. But it's going to be very, very interesting to see what happens if we get into a financial crisis, which is primarily about a bond market event as opposed to a stock market event.
You know, Eric, I can't wrap my head around this. Keith is not the only one who's shared this idea before. I've actually heard this idea thrown out there before by a number of very smart people. But in the way that I look at the markets, I can't make sense of that because at least in my mind, what's happening is we got a Fed that and now the rest of the central banks approaching this same kind of tapering that the Fed is doing, where they're reducing their balance sheets and drawing liquidity out of the marketplace. We have at the same time the governments issuing more and more debt, and they're soaking up all the available capital in doing all of their auctions and, you know, raising so much more additional capital to fund their deficits. This to me is soaking up liquidity. And as you're soaking up liquidity and it creates a bond crisis, when there's a lack of liquidity, I cannot envision a scenario where that inspires money to go to stocks. It's a reality that there is a direct relationship with yields and valuations on stocks, because whatever the yields are, it's being discounted into equity valuations. And so, you know, yeah, they've diverged for a while, but if bond markets are crashing and yields are skyrocketing, it's making stocks incredibly expensive and justifying that people are going to chase equity because I just can't make sense of it. It's not something that in my mind I can compute.
Well, I can't compute it either, but I'm thinking more about what's the alternative. Let's assume that long duration, say 5-year and longer duration fixed income, including government fixed income, treasury bonds, you don't want to be in because that's what's crashing as rates go through the roof. What are you going to do instead? And initially, you could say everybody goes to short duration. It's just all T-bills. Well, there's not enough T-bills for everybody to do that. Does the government stop issuing 10 years and just issue, you know, all short duration in order to respond to what the market wants to buy? What would the knock-on effects and consequences of something like that be? So I'm not saying that I think that there's any logical reason that you would want to favor stocks in that situation. What I'm saying is if the money is coming out of the bond market because everybody's panicking about bond prices and sees that the avalanche has begun and is not likely to stop, where do they go instead? Remember, the institutional guys can't just stay all in cash. They've got a mandate that they have to be invested in something. They normally would use the 10-year as their favorite safety trade. If that's what they're running from, what do they use instead? And I guess it's T-bills.
Well, one thing that I would push back on there is that even Keith was saying, though, that he thinks that a lot of the initial crisis may actually start in Europe and then eventually even make its way to Japan, and that each of these countries are going to take their turn. What if the bond crisis actually doesn't even start in the U.S. Treasury bond market? Everyone's sort of pushing that narrative that it's the U.S. Treasury yield that's going to be the problem. But what if actually it's global sovereigns that are blowing out, emerging market debt that's blowing out? What if it's actually corporate and junk bonds that are having their spreads blow out? Maybe, just maybe, the U.S. government bonds may still retain a bit of the safe haven element there, and it will be actually the credit spreads that are blowing out on all the shittier debt.
Well, and that's an excellent point that you make, Patrick. Let's suppose that the fundamentals are there, as everybody seems to be expecting right now, for U.S. Treasury yields to move much, much higher. But what happens is, before that really gets going, you see European junk, which, oh my gosh, talk about a ridiculously inflated bubble that needs to pop. You see things like European junk blow up first, and everybody is using that textbook safety trade that's the only thing they know, which is U.S. Treasuries. That's pushing U.S. Treasury prices up, and we get maybe even a new lower print than what everybody is assuming, that 1.34 was the bottom of the 10-year market. And it could go that way, too, if enough other stuff blew up first. And I think you make a very good argument. You know, the U.S. 10-year may not be the cleanest shirt in existence, but it's certainly not the dirtiest shirt in the pile either. If you look at European junk and European sovereigns, negative yielding sovereign debt around the world, there's a lot of other targets before U.S. Treasuries that could blow up first. And so how does that play into the equation? And if it did result, let's say, in U.S. Treasury yields surprising everyone and moving lower from here instead of higher, well, how long does that last before they move a whole lot higher in a real big hurry? Because I think that the scenario that says it doesn't start in the U.S., it starts elsewhere. Yeah, that makes sense. But it doesn't end and not come to the U.S. It eventually gets to the U.S. market. And if that's been inflated by a misplaced safety trade, where does that leave us? And potentially it's a blow off on the 10-year, maybe even a double bottom on the 10-year yield and abrupt reversal. So many scenarios, Patrick, and we've never been in a situation like this. You can't say, well, let's look at the last time that all of the central banks in the world simultaneously conjured money out of thin air and bought bonds with them, pressing interest rates to millennial low rates. It's never happened before. So we have nothing to measure this by, and I have no idea what's going to happen, but I am sure that it's going to be interesting.
Well, one thing I can assure all our Macro Voice listeners is that they'll get the play-by-play for me and you in the coming years, as we're going to be on this every single tick. Nonetheless, I want to move on. There was a great article talking about Marko Kolanovic's recent piece about the profound danger of the dollar losing its reserve status. Well, you know, that's a topic that we obviously had an entire year-end show, and we picked apart in quite extensive detail. But it was still a great piece. But what was most interesting to me was Marko Kolanovic's comment on gold at the end of the article. He talked about and said the preferred trade appears to be going long gold, not for strategic, but due to tactical reasons. So the current positioning of gold is extremely short. He goes on to then talk about, as when you take the aggregate of gold ETFs and futures as a fraction of the S&P 500 price, there were only two times in the past decade where we were this low, that near the historical lows that were reached. Once was shortly before the market crash in 2008, and the other one was right before the rally in 2016. And what was really interesting is both scenarios were very different. One was in 2008, a very risk-off moment, and in 2016, it was really a risk-on moment. But what's interesting is we're at that same kind of extreme level on gold. And what's interesting to him is that he just looks at it that there may be an opportunity here on that. Now, technically, we observed that gold is breaking down and that there certainly isn't a bid yet on gold. But boy, it's interesting to see such a smart guy like Marco having gold on his radar.
Yeah, you know, and the comments about reserve currency status were really interesting to me, too. You know, Marco is not a fringe blogger, you know, raving about gold bug conspiracy theories. He's a JP Morgan head quant. And he's talking about the gold story, and he's talking about loss of U.S. dollar reserve currency status. Meanwhile, Patrick, earlier this week at the United Nations in New York City, who do we have standing shoulder to shoulder, showing solidarity with one another and speaking out against the injustice in the world? It's not the usual characters. It's the Iranian foreign minister and the European Union's foreign policy chief, Federica Mogherini, standing shoulder to shoulder, denouncing U.S. policy to weaponize the dollar, and they have announced their intention to create a new payment mechanism as a workaround to the SWIFT system, which is basically the backbone of how dollar-denominated international trade is settled, so that businesses in Europe continue to have the ability to conduct legal commerce with Iran because, of course, Iran has not been sanctioned by the United Nations. It's only been sanctioned unilaterally by the United States. But even though the United States is acting unilaterally, it is demanding that European countries that are not under any sanction from their own governments stop doing business with Iran. The European Union is making an official announcement at the United Nations in New York City, standing shoulder to shoulder with the Iranian foreign minister, saying, we're going to right the injustice of America abusing its reserve currency issuer status, and we're going to create an alternative payment system. I couldn't believe it when I saw this, Patrick. I mean, to imagine, it's not just, a month ago, it was Germany, and I couldn't believe Germany, a U.S. ally, is speaking out publicly against U.S. policy to weaponize the dollar as a coercive foreign policy tool. Now it's the chief foreign policy officer of the European Union in a public press announcement shoulder to shoulder with the guy from Iran. And they're speaking out against U.S. policy. It really is a very different world that we're living in.
To me, it's very relevant that it's coming from Europe because, you know, when you go back to Bretton Woods and how the entire monetary system we have today has its origin in nations, it was truly an Anglo-American alliance between Europe and America that put it all together. And so it's sort of pretty significant that it's not Russia and China that is coming out to talk about de-dollarization, but it's Europe. It's pretty significant for sure. Nonetheless, Eric, one last thing I wanted to touch in post-game. There was a great sequence of articles published on Zero Hedge from Chris Cole, and the four-part series was all titled about understanding the volatility storm to come. And obviously, we had Chris Cole on the show, and we're looking forward to having him back at some point later this year. But what was really interesting to me was he was talking about some of the different liquidity factors, and this really, you know, struck a chord with me, and I wanted to just share it with our listeners. And he was talking about liquidity in the S&P 500 during the February flash crash that occurred on the VIX. And he was talking about the S&P 500. He says, the liquidity crisis in February extended beyond derivatives. Not only did the SPDR S&P 500 ETF itself, one of the most liquid exchange-traded funds in the world with capitalization of $260 billion, normally that ETF trades at a 1 cent spread. Back on the 5th and 6th of February, the average spread blew out to historical highs, became 2 cents wide, which in itself doesn't seem like a lot, 1 cent to 2 cents, but it's a to the 28th standard deviation move when that blowout of the spread. But what was crazy during that event was the SPX, the index options, some of the options actually had no bids or offers on them. And some of the other option spreads previously that had 5 cent spreads had the spreads widen as much as $3. And I look at this, it kind of resonates with me with all those traders that are currently trading actually VIX options. Look, the S&P is the S&P, and he's talking about the liquidity there. But a lot of people are turning to the VIX options, thinking that when the next time shit hits the fan in the markets, that they'll be able to cash in through volatility spiking in a very big way. But one of the things that I personally feel is that they will all be shocked in a very big way how there is going to be a total lack of liquidity being offered by dealers for them to actually monetize or profit all of their hedges from being right. To me, being in the most liquid assets when you're hedging the downside risk of the market is so important. And it really kind of resonated with me when I was reading that.
First of all, we got to get Chris Cole back on the program, so we should work on that behind the scenes. But, you know, it's going to be so interesting because I think this, a lot of what Chris Cole has said, you know, so many people congratulated him for being right. And he said, guys, you're missing the point. What I was predicting, you know, this was a backyard weenie roast compared to what I think is coming. He said the whole February VIX complex blow up event was nothing compared to what he sees on the horizon. And you listen to Keith Dickers' interview today where he's saying, you know, when we get to the bond market bubble bursting. And of course, you know, bubbles are hard to predict when they're going to burst. But when it does happen, it's been so inflated. I mean, when in, you know, recorded human history have all of the central banks of the world worked together to blow a bubble? Well, that's really what, if you think about it, they've done with sovereign debt, is they've done all this quantitative easing to artificially inflate the price of sovereign debt to bring the yields down. And if, as I've always said, there's no free lunch and the piper has to be paid, it gets paid when that bond bubble breaks. And I don't know if that's coming in the next year or if it's still a long ways off. I've been surprised that we've made it this long. When it does, though, as you say, a lot of assumptions are going to be tested and illiquid instruments won't work and there will be breakdowns all over the place. And I think, as we discussed with Keith Dicker today, it's bigger than just financial markets, you know, and I've worried in the past about conditions of markets and losing money and whatever. I'm worried about, as Ray Dalio has said so vocally, or tried to say, if CNBC hadn't cut him off in mid-sentence, that, you know, this is going to be about the social impact to the world. The next financial crisis is not going to be an event that finance guys care about. It's going to be an event for the history books that has to do with just horrific consequences for society, because we're not prepared to bail things out the way that we were in 2008. And it's going to be ugly. So, as you said, we'll be there every step of the way reporting on it. But Patrick, I think we should leave it there in the interest of time. So please do work on Chris Cole. See if we can get him scheduled. I know you've got most of the rest of the year already booked out. And in the meantime, folks, we need your help promoting Macro Voices, because the more registered users we have, the more able Patrick is to negotiate to get the very best feature interview guests. So please forward your research roundups, tell your friends and colleagues, and most importantly, if you haven't done so already, register your free account at macrovoices.com. Doesn't cost you a penny, only takes a minute. We won't spam you or sell your email address. What we will do is send you our free research roundup email each week, which contains download links for our own content as well as all of the best stuff that we can find on the internet. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's research roundup.
All right, well, this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview with Keith. You're going to find a link to the chart book that also accompanied the interview. Also the link to that four-part series from Chris Cole, so all of you can read that in greater detail, as well as that article we referenced from Marco Kolonovic about the danger of the dollar losing its reserve status. You will find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Srezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.